khaki diodes back to back, you can protect it with filters. Because most likely the two antennas and the two transmitters are not, a transmitter and receiver, are not on the exact same frequency. So when you're really studying it, I think you're going to find out that only one of the receivers really requires a relay. The rest of them can easily be protected in a passive manner. And whenever you put bandpass filters and other kinds of filters in the system, you're going to be protecting yourself from all kinds of things that happen in the metro area. You happen to live in a radio-rich environment of Staten Island. You're on a high hill. You're very close to New York City. There's a lot of potent signals in your neighborhood. Anything you can do to filter through the desired signals and filter away the undesired signals are going to create an awful lot of lack of intermodulation, distortion, and funny receiver responses that you might get once in a while. So I would make the measurements first before designing the circuitry, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, at least you've given me some comfort. I was really worried about that. I picture those things spinning like motors under some conditions. But I'm using only 100 watts at this time, so I usually less than 100 watts, so then I really don't think I have much to worry about. But I can put my spectrum analyzer on here, do some transmission measurements, so, and then see what happens. And if you have time, I just have one more quick antenna question.
Go for it, John.
Okay, Dick, I'm going to describe an antenna that I want to erect, which is pretty simple. It will be 10 feet off the ground. It's going to be a long wire antenna. I'm going to come out of my shack with number 14 wire, run out about 75 feet, make a hairpin turn, and come back 75 feet into the shack where I'm going to put a variable resistor and a tuning capacitor. Will this antenna, that's the only one I can put in this location, what do you think I'd be able to do with an antenna like that?
I'm kind of curious why you're building what I would call half of a folded dipole. Why do you want to fold it back on itself? In the case of a real folded dipole, where it goes out to the left and curves around, goes out to the right and curves around, comes back with a roughly a 300 ohm feed, it is the current that flows to the center of the wire that's not interrupted that's really doing the radiating, in my opinion. And so now, that high current point that you're going to be creating, I'm assuming now you're going out a quarter wave on your favorite frequency. So yes, you can bring it back into the shack, and you can have a variable reactance network, inductor capacitor. I don't recommend you put a resistor in the shack. Unless you're trying to run a beverage, there's no reason to take this valuable RF energy and turn it into heat. You would get slightly better performance, in my opinion, if you run the wire out as straight as you can, out once, and just suspend it with an insulator, and put the right kind of an antenna tuner in the shack with reference to ground. Being only 10 feet off the ground, if you're on HF frequencies, you're a little bit close wavelength-wise. It's going to be a near-vertical incident skywave antenna. But when you're feeding one end of a long wire, and you've got an antenna tuner that's got enough tuning range to it, you can easily match a tremendous number of frequencies, and as long as you've got the right kind of a counterpoise, you can have real good efficiency of that of that transmitting, John. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, the run would be about 75 feet to the turnaround point in one direction. I would be running from north to south and then coming back north again. And that would give me a total length of 150 feet. But I never built an antenna like that. I don't know what I could achieve with it. But if I could just run the 75 feet run, a 75 foot run, and use the antenna tuner at 10 feet, I could try that. That would be easier for me to do.
I think I recommend that you do both, John. Run one piece of wire out there, 75 feet, with an antenna tuner, against a known good ground somewhere in the shack. It'd be nice to have a whole ground plane radial system, but you don't necessarily, unless you're really measuring efficiency. Maybe you're using this primarily as a receiving antenna. You only need the super ground plane radials if you're trying to get high efficiency as a transmitter. As a receiving site, that extra resistance on the ground plane side doesn't matter. Yes, it means you don't get quite as high an S meter reading. That means you receive a little bit less of the signal because of the resistive effect, and you receive a little bit less of the noise. But the signal-to-noise ratio will stay almost the same. So as a receiving site, you can get away with murder. But I would build both. And one of them will be easier to tune than the other, depending on how you set it up and what, depending on what frequencies you're going to. There's some advantages of each. But you have the resources to put up both antennas and compare them, John. Compare them in signal strength, tuning capability, bandwidth, ease of tuning, and so on. And I don't know of anybody doing this hairpin circuit the way you described, but maybe it's time somebody do. Over to you, John, K2RAW.
Hey, Dick. Well, the wire's cheap, and I've got plenty of it, so I will do as you suggest. I'll run both. It'll cost me a 75-foot run and a 150-foot run. I'll try both of those, and yes, I will probably be using them more for receive than transmit. And I do have a well-grounded area here in the shop, so I do have a very large ground area.
A very large ground area in the shack. What is that, John? Is it your water pipe system, or you got a whole bunch of ground plane radios from some other antenna? How about you, John?
I have a Trident grounding system outside of my shack, which is tied into all of the Kindorf supports for the antenna poles, and also to the copper strip that runs behind my bench for all the grounding. So it's a pretty expensive thing. It's only around 4 ohms to ground under ideal conditions, and it's about 12 ohms to ground under dry conditions.
Very nice. Has anything on your property ever been struck with lightning nearby, John? Over to you.
Yes, I've been struck twice. One was a tree strike, and one was on one of my masts. Did a little damage on the mast, but no damage to the equipment and no damage to the shack at all.
Damage to the mast? Tell me what the damage to the mast looked like.
I had a right angle offset, which must have been the striking point, I assume. And on that, I had what looked like a flayed-out disc cone antenna for 50 to 1300 meg, just for receiving, and that got blown to pieces.
So that sounds like it was a direct strike, doesn't it? To get blown to pieces sounds like a few microseconds of thousands of amperes. Sounds like you really got hit. Is the metal on your property the tallest thing on Todd Hill? Because I think you're very close to Todd Hill. Is that the tallest chunk of metal around? No other trees or anything else is higher than you. Are you the local lightning arrestor, John? And how tall above earth is your tallest piece of metal on your property?
Poles themselves are approximately 30 feet. They're 22-foot, 3-inch diameter galvanized pipes. 7 foot on top of it, so that's 30 feet. Now I have 18 and 20-foot antennas on top of that, so that's the height over the ground that I am. And my elevation is about 250 above me, like in high world.
Yeah, I'm sitting 300 feet above earth, above sea level, and then 100 feet of tower. So I'm reasonably sure that you and I have direct line of sight. If I had, I'm going to ask you now for a speculation. If there was a video camera at the top of your 10-foot high antenna, on top of your 30 feet of mast, and I now swung that camera on an azimuth bearing, on an azimuth gimbal, 360 degrees, and watched the screen, do I see the horizon in most directions? Are you the tallest thing around there, John? Go ahead.
I have a hill that's a little higher than me to my direct north. Now, sweeping south from north, clockwise direction, from there I'm totally open all the way down to Sandy Hook, and a little bit to the right of that, I would say maybe from 0 to 220 degrees, 230 degrees. Then I start coming into the hills of Bagamy, which is Toad Hill, and then to my north is Emerson Hill.
That Toad Hill that's taller than you and the trees on top of it, the peak of that hill, is that a block away? Or is that a quarter of a mile away? How far away is that peak of that hill, John? Go ahead.
About a mile and a half from me, and it's at 411 feet.
Okay. From what you're describing, the terrain leads me to believe that you will be struck with lightning once in a while. and you've already been struck twice to your knowledge, and I presume you've been living there like 30 years, and I'm guessing that most of that 30 years that kind of hardware was there. You are a local lightning arrestor for a few blocks around your home, as I see it, Sean. Go ahead.
I think my house is 125 years old. My family's here 100 years. Just to let you know.
It sounds like you're going to stay a while. You guys don't jump around in location very much. Many families move every 5 years. They outgrow their house. They outgrow, maybe they fill up the ashtrays or they fill up the cesspool. I'm not quite sure what it is. A hell of a lot of people move every 5 or 8 years. So are you telling me that, Barry was born in the house that he's living in, Barry Into Moon Bounce? Are you coming close to that situation that John Gahead?
Oh, yes, Dick. I was born not too far from here. Staten Island Hospital, right in Staten Island. The only time I was off the island for any length of time was during the war effort when my father was transferred to Akron, Rubber Town, USA. But other than that, no, I'm a Staten Islander.
My goodness, and you planted. Wow. But I should talk. Let me think now. 1969? 40, going on 42 years I've been in the same house. And it looks at, I've got to do some changes. Got to make some changes. Okay, I've got this beautiful report from Wes, in which I see that he bought an NMR oscillator. I really don't know what frequency that's on or what it is. And that pulsing network, I'm not quite sure what that is. But the price was right, and it looks like you enjoy owning them. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJN. yes, that triggers the entire interest in the area of nuclear magnetic resonance and trying to understand the phenomenon that is attached to that. So, also, by purchasing the other device, which is the pulse-forming module that operates on the high frequency, quite a good few thousand volts, I was trying to find out what I can do with it, because the price was pretty excellent. The guy dropped the price because of my request, and he even said that, yes, it is an odd device. Let me drop. Nuclear magnetic resonance. It looks like there was a number of experiments that was made based on that first device that I have purchased, which is a generator. It's not a generator. It is being called NMR oscillator. What it does have a 3 BNC inputs. One is signal, the other one is bias, and the other one is RF. It does have 2 banana plugs for 24.5 volts of DC powering. On the right-hand side of this long box, I have a PL connector for, like typical one used for HF antenna. On left-hand side, I have a super quality dial, a mechanical one. And when I open up the box, I see the long insulating rod, looks like a pencil. And at the end of that rod, there's a very high quality, precise, very small air capacitor. Before I go to that, how it works. Well, it works this way that trying to describe it properly. You deliver the 2 different signals into that. So one is being called RF and the other one goes to the signal. And then these 2 signals are nearby the same frequency. Then One is being used as a modulator, and the other one is kind of steady signal. And I'm trying to sweep the DC field slowly by moving signal and using the modulation to reduce the need for highly stable DC magnetic field. And that allows me to employ the Larkin detection technique, which could be a Larkin amplifier, and then increase the signal to noise ratio to get that NMR signal. Then use the modulation to enhance the signal that would be used for kind of spectroscopy. All I need for it is not much. It is just the spectrometer, very easily done, which would be that the PL connector of my generator will be connected to the small coil. And that coil will actually serve...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about that. So, the PL connector is connected to the small coil. The small coil is wrapped around the sample. The sample could be any liquid or organic material. And then it will go in the resonance. Now, I would be able to see the variation between the first frequency and the second frequency. The detection is being done by XYZ structure, which I would like you to describe for the audience, as you have a much better vocabulary for it. In other words, is the Z axis is vertical, XY axis is on the horizontal plane. At the certain conditions, I'm able to tilt the Z axis by the certain angle, and that it's like a spin. When you have a small top, when you were the child and you try to put it in motion, then you all of a sudden see that when the top is losing the power, it's trying to wobble around the Z axis. Now that angle between the vertical Z axis and the axis of that spin is the angle that is important for us, called the nuclear magnetic resonance. Now, what is happening is that secondary axis that is tilted is being used by the spin still to spin around that axis. So, if you could enlighten us in this area, I would appreciate it. Back to you.
That spin that you're describing is called precession. If I start off with a child's top, I'm spinning it nice and fast, and the axis of rotation of the top is directly perpendicular to the floor. Under those conditions, the top has no precession. Eventually, the top settles a little bit into some particular direction. In other words, the axis of spin of the top eventually becomes slightly non-perpendicular to the floor that the top is on. The center of gravity of the top is somewhere in the middle of the top, and the top is being suspended by the floor at the tip of the top at the bottom. So because the center of gravity is above the center of support, and because gravity is pulling on that center of gravity, center of mass of the top, you could say the top is being pushed in such a way that Mother Nature's gravity is trying to tilt the top such a way that it's eventually going to lay flat to the floor. Every gyroscope, if I've got a gyroscope like this top spinning on the floor, and it's got an axis of rotation going through the center, and if I take that upper portion of the shaft of the axis, assume now that the top is spinning clockwise, top view, and I take that shaft, the top of that shaft, and I attempt to push it to the north compared to the point of support down at the bottom of the top. So the top of the shaft coming out of this theoretical top, I'm attempting to push it to the north. Let me drop. When I do that, the way a top works is that no matter what force therefore, of changing its axis direction you apply, it always responds at right angles. I'm taking the top of that shaft, I'm pushing it to the north, the top will respond by the shaft moving to the east when the top is spinning clockwise. If the top were spinning counterclockwise, it would move to the west. But the top, the shaft of the top will always move at right angles to the force that I'm supplying. So let's assume now that the top was starting off, this is a real child spinning top, and I've spun it up, and I've spun it up not very carefully, where the shaft is not perpendicular to the floor, but the shaft is tilted a little bit toward the north. The top of the shaft is tilted toward the north. Gravity is applying a force that's trying to pull it further to the north. The top responds by moving to the east. The shaft moves to the east. Now that the shaft is at the east, the center of gravity, the center of mass of the top, gravity is pulling down on it, trying to pull it further to the east, the top responds by moving to the south. And as you can see, I'm slowly walking around the circle, and I'm explaining step by step what precession is. So a spinning, rotating object that has gyroscopic action, where you're attempting to change the axis orientation, that axis of spin will always move at right angles. Let me drop. Now, that explains precession. Magnetically, when it comes to a molecule of magnetic material, or potentially magnetic material, there's three things that I now realize make magnetism. You can have spin of something in the nucleus, you have spin of the electron, and you have orbital motion of the electron. Each of those three objects can make a magnetic field. I don't know which one makes the strongest one, but the two most interesting ones are the spin of the electron and the orbital motion of the electron. The spin of the electron and the orbital motion of the electron could be parallel axis of spin. The axis of rotation could be parallel to each other. But the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, not Heisenberg, I'm trying to think of Pauli exclusion principle, says that I've got every pair of electrons that are in orbit around the nucleus of a molecule or of a atom must spin in opposite directions. So you could say one is spinning with its axis up, one electron is spinning with its axis down, and both of them are in orbital motion around the nucleus. So of the two magnetic fields that are being made by an electron, spin and orbital motion, two of them are cophase, two of them are antiphase. When you try to supply an external magnetic field, which is not exactly oriented with the axis of rotation of the spin axis or the orbital axis of the electron, the magnetic field of the electron tries to align itself. That means you're applying a force that's trying to...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
That means you're applying a magnetic force that's trying to change the axis of rotation of either the spin axis of the electron or the orbital axis. Therefore, you're going to create precession. You're going to create a precession of each of the pair of electrons. If it happened to be a pair of electrons, you're going to create precession and different amounts of precession because two of those magnetic generating mechanisms are... One of those magnetic mechanisms, meaning a spin and orbital motion, are cophase, and one of them are antiphase. So the precession that you create is two different precessions, slightly different magnitude. I'm not sure, but I think this explains the Zeeman effect. The Zeeman effect means that when I look at the spectrum coming out of a molecule that has been ionized, ionized means that I applied extra energy to the molecule such that its electrons are now in a higher orbit than they're not in the base orbit, they're in a higher orbit, and periodically they're going to be hopping back down. When they hop back down from a higher orbit to a lower orbit, there's an extremely specific wavelength, a specific amount of energy at a very specific wavelength that they must emit during that transition. In the presence of the magnetic field where I'm creating this precession of these two different molecules, I get two different amounts of energy. And that explains, I think that explains, why the Zeeman effect will take one single line that exists out of a ionized molecule in the absence of a presence of an absence of a magnetic field, and I now apply a local magnetic field, and that single line breaks up into two individual lines of a known spacing between the two. So when you use your radio telescope, let me drop. You use your radio telescope, and you're looking at a cloud of hydrogen, and that cloud of hydrogen is 5 billion light years away. And you're looking at the emission of those hydrogen molecules, and you recognize what the hydrogen alpha molecule wavelength looks like. It's a 647 or something like that nanometers. It's a very specific wavelength. And if you're smart enough to aim your telescope precisely at, say, the center of the cloud, the right-hand side of the cloud, the left-hand side of the cloud, and you look at the amount of Zeeman effect you get when you aim at those various places, you now know the strength of the local magnetic field. You're remotely measuring the strength of a magnetic field, and you can be doing it from 5 billion light years away. It's kind of an amazing process. And now, nuclear magnetic resonance uses some of these phenomena. Let me drop. My understanding of nuclear magnetic resonance is that you've got a rather strong magnetic field that your sample is being exposed to. You put a brief pulse of RF energy into the substance, and as the pulse of energy creates some kind of a spin, which I don't quite understand, and as that spin spins down, as the energy you put in relaxes, the energy that comes back out, and timing it and measuring the amplitude and the phase and whatever, allows you to, by the three-dimensional imaging technique, I can't even think of the name of it, but there's an imaging technique that allows you to make a three-dimensional image. You have to rotate the machinery around the substance also. You've got to translate the substance through it, your sample. But let me just give a couple of words on pulse-forming network. Let me drop. In the old days, when one of the most popular ways of making a radar was to make brief pulses out of a magnetron, what you really want to do, if your particular magnetron needed 5,000 volts, you gave it a 5,000-volt pulse that lasted for, let's say, 1 microsecond. How did you do that? One way of doing it is to start off with some kind of a transmission line structure. It might really be an assemblage of inductors and capacitors that are grouped together to act like a transmission line. In some cases, it really was a transmission line. But you charge the transmission line with a external power supply, a 5,000-volt power supply, maybe it's a 10,000-volt power supply, through a charging resistor. And this whole network is capacitively coupled to your magnetron. You ground one end of the transmission line, and that will make a pulse, if in my example, 5,000 volts, and if the amount, if the length of the transmission line is equivalent electronically to a 1 microsecond length of transmission line, I'm discharging the charged energy that I put into that transmission line by creating the ground. Maybe I did that with a thyrotron or something like that. I create a ground. The energy that was in the transmission line dumps itself with good impedance matching into the magnetron. And because I've set up that pulse-forming network to be able to create a pulse of exactly 1 microsecond of length, I'll get a beautiful rectangular pulse that lasts for 1 microsecond, and then I've completely discharged it by the ground that I put in there, and it sits there and nothing else happens until I open the circuit. The charging resistor very slowly charges the transmission line back, and a millisecond later, I'm ready to ground it again and start the next radar pulse cycle. So for a lot of years...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So for a lot of years, a very simple pulse-forming network was used on a lot of these radars. Ordinarily, to make a 5,000-volt pulse with a beautiful rectangular waveform, if you did it with ordinary transistors acting like an amplifier, that would be a very difficult process. To do it with a simple transmission line that through a 100,000-ohm resistor from a 5,000-volt or a 10,000-volt power supply, you slowly charge it, and you simply discharge it by closing the switch on a thyrotron, and this pulse-forming network makes this beautiful pulse that runs your magnetron. for the 1 microsecond that you need it. It's a very simple network. I am guessing that the pulses that are created in a nuclear magnetic resonance machine, NMR as it used to be called, now it's called MRI, I'm guessing that although they're operating at HF frequencies, I'm guessing that the pulse forming network runs by a somewhat similar process.
That's correct.
If you study the Skolnick book on radar techniques, on introduction to radar, and you look at the chapter on pulse forming networks, I think you're going to find something very similar. It's got a lot of history way back to World War II. N2XJN, KTYYW.
You're correct in this area. In early version of the NMR, there was a Bohr magnetron that was utilized for it. And everything snapped together. Basically, one of the things that is very much essential to understand NMR spectroscopy is to consider just two protons in different locations in the organic molecule. The magnetic field at proton A is the vector sum of the externally applied field, and that local field of the molecule at point, let's say, A, in general, the local field of the molecule B will be different. So the protons A and B are in different total magnetic fields, and they have different NMR resonance frequencies. So basically, the resonance frequency of each proton in the molecule is different. That phenomenon gives me the ability to concentrate on each and every individual molecule and trying to find each and every individual proton in it. Isn't that amazing? Let me stop. Now, when I was trying to describe the device that I had purchased, basically the NMR spectrometer would use the principle of the sample that is placed inside a coil, which is the small coil that is placed at the PL connector. The inductance L, which is in parallel with the variable capacitor that I described, and will have will then work with the capacitance of this capacitor and can be adjusted by this capacitor, let's say within 100 picofarad to the 30 picofarad. Then the LC circuit that is formed is the heart of that RF oscillator that operates at the resonant frequency of that LC circuit. And the locking detection by means of locking amplifier allows to detect the AC signal even in the presence of noise voltages as much as a million times larger. And that function depends on the fact that the frequency of noise wants to eliminate the difference from the signal. So for the noisy signal, we are able to simply measure the average signal voltage to noise, and then it will obscure the signal. That's what I understand from that. Back to you.
Now, one of the things, by the way, I didn't mention when you're using your radio telescope and you're measuring that cloud of hydrogen, for instance, that's some number of billions of light years away. I think, but I'm not positive, that when you're using your radio telescope in a polarimetry manner, in other words, you measure how much up and down, how much left and right is the polarization of the signals you're getting. And I think they also look at clockwise and counterclockwise, circular polarization. By measuring those Stokes parameters, I think they're called, I'm able to figure out what is the orientation of the magnetic field that cloud is being subjected to that's creating the Zeeman effect. I think the Zeeman effect changes in characteristics as I rotate the polarization of reception of the radio telescope. So I think I'm able to measure how much magnetic field and what is the direction and nature of the magnetic field by doing polarimetry of the Zeeman effect that I'm measuring. Now, whether or not the tomography technique that's used, let me drop. The three-dimensional picture generating technique that's called tomography. Tomography would translate into tumor photograph, but you're making a three-dimensional picture. I'm guessing by the way the NMR or MRI machine has a huge rotary ring to it. In other words, all of that machinery is being rotated around the specimen while the specimen is being translated through the machine. But the rotation of that, I think, is the equivalent of the polarimetry measurement that's done with radio astronomy. So by measuring the timing of the pulses, the magnitude of the echo versus time, the amount of Zeeman effect, I think, is being measured, but I'm not sure. And then by rotating the machinery around the spectrum, I'm able to get a slice of a picture that across the slice, I know an awful lot about what kind of molecules are present across that slice as the specimen is being translated through the machine. It's with rather simple techniques on the outside at rather low frequencies, when the process is being done correctly, I think I'm able to reconstruct a rather nice two-dimensional picture per slice, and as I put all those slices together, as I translate the specimen through the machine, I'm eventually getting a three-dimensional slice. Each of the organs within that human being, in the case of an MRI, is being measured. There's a different amount of water and oxygen and hydrogen and whatever content. A kidney has got different constituent compared to an intestine, for instance. Therefore, it's giving you a different magnitude of echo, and those echoes, the timing and the magnitude, eventually allows you to make a picture. That's the little bit of understanding I got of an MRI machine. I haven't studied an MRI machine at all yet, as you can tell. Over to you, Mel. It sounds like you would like to at least build a rudimentary version of an NMR machine analyze substances, analyze specimens. It sounds like the direction you're going. It sounds like you want to at least understand it, but you're acquiring the hardware where you could possibly build one. Looks like there's going to be a homebrew version of one in Queens. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Well, basically, that's what you were talking about, Zeeman effect, is very much snapped to the Laimer precession. But before we go to the Laimer precession, we should explain how it is. Well, yes, you're right that the hardware that I'm taking is called miniature, a version of the NMR, which is very easy to be done. And the few articles that I have sent, at least one of them, explain how to make it on the bench and see it on the oscilloscope, see the real resonance. Now, as I said, as we sweep the frequency, we are able to move from one molecule to the other because they have a different magnetic potential. Let me drop. And see what is the resonance frequency or nuclear resonance frequency of the sample. The reason that I'm doing it is not because I'm interested with the organic structures at all. I'm interested with nuclear magnetic resonance and with ferrite. And that, where the subject that we're discussing right now will start to be excited. But before I go to that, the Laimer precession. Well, at first we have a bulk magnetization in an experiment when we observe not just one molecule, but very large number of molecules, let's say 10 to 20, and we need a net effect of this nuclei or nucleus, and we need to find out how they behave being like a small Bohr magnet. To be more precise, a magnet movement is the one that makes the change to the overall field. When you said about the large structure of the magnet that is moving, let me drop. I can picture, yes, it is moving, only if we try to create three-dimensional picture of that. But essentially, the whole concept is based on the X, Y, Z, where Z is vertical and X and Y is horizontal. Now, if you have that top that is tilting from the Z on its own Z1 direction vector, then everything is simple because the spin is moving in opposite direction to the right hand rule, till you for one moment start to do the trick. You try to move all entire XY around the horizontal pattern with the speed of the top. That's one of the things that I have a question for. What would then happen to the top if you try to rotate XY with the speed of the spin? Let me drop. The line of precession. The tip, the magnetization vector is away from the Z axis, such that it makes the angle B to the axis. Once tilted away from the Z axis, we can find that the magnetization vector rotates about the direction of the magnetic field, sweeping out cone with the constant angle. And the vector is said to precess about the field for the particular motion called Lymer precession. And that has a direct connection with the Zeeman effect. And then the detection is being done this way. The precession of the magnetization vector is what we actually detect in the NMR experiment. The small coil of wire around the sample, with the axis of the coil aligned in the XY plane, then the whole process is analogous to the way in which the electric current can be generated by the magnet rotating inside the coil. And the coil detects the X component of the magnetization. In other words, we're not really dealing with the real rotation, but rather imaginary rotation that is taking place. Let me stop. And then we have a pulses that actually makes the detection possible. So, let's say we have a question that how do we can rotate the magnetization away from the equilibrium position along the Z axis, and all that is required is, let's say, suddenly replace the magnetic field along the Z axis with one of XY plane. If we could do it. But we cannot do it physically. We're dealing with the creon, driven supermagnet, if I can use this term.
I think you mean cryogenic supermagnet, right?
Yes, cryogenic, thank you very much. This is not so good. And we cannot do it. So the idea is to apply a very small magnetic field along the X axis, but one with the which is the oscillating at or near the Lymer frequency, and that is a resonance with the Lymer frequency. So all we do is feed some radio frequency RF power to the coil, and then resulting oscillating current creates an oscillating magnetic field along the resulting field. And this one is called the radio frequency field. Now, you've got to understand that in NMR, we have two sources of the signal. One of them is a modulating signal called signal. That's one of my inputs. And the other one is RF. I assume that RF, that this technology was created not really by ham radio amateurs, and they didn't really relay on the scientific meaning of RF. They would use it as a jargon. as a form of the flank. That's why that they named them differently. And in plenty of scientific papers, I found that description how this signal and the RF different in the two inputs. Now, my question to you is. Before I go, I just finished the pulses and the vector model. So, all we do is feed some radio frequency power into the coil, and then we have that resulting oscillating current that creates an oscillating magnetic field. And then we rotate the magnetization, and we introduce the idea of the rotating frame. Now, that the question of mine was, when I'm not clear in this area, I'm kind of lost in that rotating frame, which is the rotating XY axis. Suppose we think that the nucleus, about nucleus with a positive gyrometric ratio, recall that this means that the Lehmer frequency is negative. So that in the sense of precession is from X to minus Y. And this is the same direction as the rotation of the structure. So it turns out that the other field, which is rotating in the opposite sense to the line of precession. Now you've got to understand that we have two vectors in horizontal. One is moving to the left and one is moving to the right. So the other one has no significant interaction with the magnetization, and we could ignore it. So now we employ that mathematical trick, and we move the coordinate system, XY, which is rather being static in laboratory frame, is rotating about the Z-axis in the same direction, at the same rate as the B field. And then we have a set of the rotating axis that if we have two vectors on the horizontal plane, one moving to the left and one moving to the right, by making them once at the same position, we increase the length of the vector and the power of that vector, if I said it properly. Now, what happens to the spin if we start to rotate? If we start to rotate the X, Y at the same exactly speed as the top.
Okay. I'd like to explain what I think is causing the rate of precession of a top. And I think it's related to your question. Okay, if I go on with that?
Go ahead, please.
I've got a child's top. I've spun it up and assumed that my magic top always spins at the exact same speed. In reality, a top slows down and life gets complicated. But assume that my top is spinning at the exact same speed all the time. And I start off with the top tilted a little bit, the axis is tilted a little bit to the north. So as soon as I let go of the top, the gravity is trying to pull it down further to the north. It responds by moving to the east, and so on. It starts the precession process. Assume I've got a rod coming out of the center of the top. The rod is parallel to the spin axis, and the rod sticks out of the top by, let's say, 6 inches. And I put that rod there, and the rod is made out of light material, and it's stiff, and it doesn't change anything. But now I put a spherical mass, a weight, at the top of that rod. What I've done is I've raised the mass center of the top. So now, for the same amount of tilt of the top, the mass center is higher above the floor, therefore gravity is applying a greater moment to tilt the axis of the top. If I did that, I measure the precession rate of the top before I add the mass, and maybe it precesses once every 2 seconds, full cycle of precession. I add the extra mass on the top, which raises the center of gravity of the top, which means gravity effects are now providing a larger moment angle, a larger moment force to tilt the axis of the top. And once I add that mass, I think the top might now precess once per second instead of once per 2 seconds. I doubled the precession rate of the top by adding...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I doubled the precession rate of the top by adding that extra mass on the top of that shaft. Okay? Now I go over to a YIG filter, a YIG-tuned filter or a YIG-tuned oscillator, which also precesses. As I change the rate, as I change the magnitude of the magnetic field, I'm really creating a force, a moment force, that's trying to tilt the axis of rotation of that spin axis inside those molecules of the YIG material. As I go to a stronger magnetic field, the force to reorient that axis is stronger, and the top and the molecules, the magnetic field of the molecules, precesses at a faster rate. That to me explains why, if I double the magnetic field that my YIG sphere sees, I double the rate at which it precesses, which doubles the frequency at which it couples energy from coil number one to coil number two, those two coils that are at right angles of my YIG-tuned filter. So the strength of magnetic field has a definite effect on precession rate. Let me drop.
In magnetic resonance, we have also two coils that are at right angles.
I understand. Now, it is my belief that most NMR machines or MRI machines have a cryogenic magnet that creates a very strong, steady-state magnetic field. There is a second coil in there that has a sawtooth amplitude waveform on it, which creates a sweeping magnetic field. So the strength of the magnetic field that the sample is being subjected to is being swept in a sawtooth manner. As you sweep that magnetic field that the substance that the sample sees, the precession rate of those molecules in that sample is increasing and decreasing at that sawtooth waveform. I think that is part of the mechanism that allows you to differentiate a kidney from a piece of intestine, that they have a slightly different molecule, different amount of water, or different amount of other atoms that are in that organ, and as I sweep the strength of the magnetic field, and I'm sweeping the precession rate of those atoms, my pickup coil is able to see, I think, different frequencies coming out of those different organs. That's what I think is taking place, but I'm guessing here. Over to you, Wes, N2XJN, K2LIW.
Question on precession.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I understand the top, and that's a good explanation. What do you think of the major influence for our 26,000-year precession of the Earth?
Okay. The Earth axis is tilted compared to the plane. We go around the Sun, and that sweeps out a plane. The orbital motion of the Earth around the Sun, that sweeps out a plane. The Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees compared to that plane. Our axis is 23.5 degrees from being normal. The Earth rotates around an axis that gives it a shape that you and I call oblate spheroid. The oblate spheroid means that the diameter of the Earth in the equatorial region is considerably greater than the diameter across the polar region. So if I draw a circle around the equator, I get a certain circumference, so I can measure the diameter in the equator region. I then can measure the distance between the North Pole and the South Pole. Between the North Pole and the South Pole, I'll get a much smaller distance than if I measure from the international dateline at the equator over to the prime meridian at the equator. The equator is wider. In other words, the Earth really is a kind of a gyroscope where there is more girth at the equator than there is at the poles. As such, the gravitational influence of the Sun acting on that distribution of mass on the Earth is trying to create a situation where the axis of rotation of the Earth is normal to the plane that it sweeps around the, uh, the, 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 The Earth, when it goes around the sun, sweeps out a plane. When it sits at 23.5 degrees, let me drop. We are tilted 23.5 degrees compared to that plane. The sun's gravity gradient is trying to align us directly so that the axis of spin is perpendicular to that plane. We're 23.5 degrees away from it. That restoring force creates a precession of the Earth that's 126,000 years, I think. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, you're right, it's 26,000 years. Okay, so the sun influence is trying to pull the equator parallel with the plane of the orbit is what's causing the precession. And I assume the moon must have a minor disturbance in it that is involved. But that's the explanation for that. Okay, because I was wondering if we had a top, which is fixed at a fulcrum on the table, and of course if the table is spinning as fast as the top, I do not think it would make any difference in the precession of the top. But I was wondering if the top was able to spin in space, if it would have precession also.
The answer is no. I have watched the Apollo astronauts, I said Apollo, the space shuttle astronauts spin a top in space. It does not precess. There is no restoring force. In the case of the top that's spinning on the table, as long as the axis is a little bit non-perpendicular, the fact that the center of mass of the top is above the point of contact with the table, gravity pulling on that center of mass is trying to lay the top down. So gravity is continuously supplying a force that takes the tilt of the axis of rotation and tries to exaggerate it. And when I added an extra mass to the top of that shaft on my theoretical top, I increased the force also, and I increased the precession rate. So it's the attempt to tilt the axis that creates the precession. If I operated that top in my spaceship, while my spaceship is being accelerated at 1G, I would get, let's say, a precession rate of once every 2 seconds. I slow down the acceleration of my rocket so that it's only being experiencing half a G on that table, and the precession rate will also slow down. As I eventually stop using the rocket motor, and I'm now in free space floating, the top will stop precessing altogether. There has to be a force attempting to move the axis. There's got to be a moment arm attempting to move that axis to create precession. Without that force, there is no precession, as I see it. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that's understood. So whether it's gravity that's artificially created or created by some mass, that'll achieve the precession. Okay, very good. Back to you, Dick.
And now let me try this on you, and you're going to suddenly see something you've never seen before. Assume I've got an ordinary bicycle wheel parallel to the table. The axis that it's rotating on, I got the shaft of this bicycle wheel with its normal bearings. This is the front wheel of my bicycle. I've got the bicycle parallel to the table, let's say parallel to the ground, and the shaft that it's rotating on is perpendicular to the ground. And I spin that bicycle wheel real nicely and let go of it, it'll sit there as a really big top, and it'll appear to have very little precession. Assume now that I'm watching the tube coming out of the bicycle wheel where I pump it up, the stem. I'm watching the stem, and let me put some white paint on the stem, just to make sure I can really see it as it goes around. So I've got this white stem zipping around as the wheel turns. And now, assume that the bicycle wheel is turning clockwise, top view. I'm looking down on it, and it's turning clockwise. Assume that at the instant I'm about to analyze the bicycle wheel, let me drop. The instant that I'm about to analyze the bicycle wheel, the stem with the white paint on it is exactly south at that instant. And I, with my hand, have grabbed the shaft, the upper shaft, the end of the shaft, furthest away from the ground, and I'm attempting to push that shaft to the north. If the bicycle wheel wasn't spinning, and I push that shaft to the north, the stem that's on the southern end of the wheel would suddenly raise higher off the ground. Can you see that picture? This bicycle wheel, for the instant right now that I'm analyzing, it's not spinning. The stem is to the south. I'm taking the upper end of that shaft, and I'm pushing it to the north. That means the southern end of the wheel is going to raise above the ground. The northern end of the wheel is going to go closer to the ground. Do you get that picture so far, John? Go ahead.
Absolutely agree with that picture.